Struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Do you feel your nonprofit's not getting enough in monthly recurring donations? If so, then you need Sharing the Credit. Every time you go into a business and swipe your debit or credit card, one of the fees taken out by Visa and MasterCard at the end of the month goes back into the system. Now, normally this is a bank, but it is legally allowed to go to a registered nonprofit. Sharing the Credit worked with a small local nonprofit. They took this information to their donor base, and 19 businesses started using Sharing the Credit. Now, this small local nonprofit receives $11,000 in monthly recurring, unrestricted, ongoing donations. This is the definition of sustainable funding. Businesses have to take plastic, so they might as well use part of those fees to support their favorite cause, your nonprofit. Check out my affiliate link in the show notes for Sharing the Credit. Book a call with Will Black and start your journey to more donations and better relationships today. Hey, welcome back to the show. Today I'm here with Huda Ilyasji. Huda, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Travis. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fabulous. For those that follow me regularly, I'm on a road trip right now. I've actually connected with Huda, and she's in Oklahoma City, and I'm not. What are you going to do?
Traded places. I love it.
Traded places. I'm on the road, and she's there. So we missed each other, but looking forward to meeting her in person when I get back into town. Huda, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do with Saxum?
Yeah, I'm just glad to be here with you today. I am the Chief Client Officer at Saxum. Saxum's a purpose-driven agency. We're based in Oklahoma City, but we have clients that we serve all across the United States. And I personally am very passionate about nonprofits and philanthropic organizations. I've been working at Saxum for the last 15 years and had the great privilege and honor of working with hundreds of nonprofits on all sorts of different issues. And so excited to jump into a conversation with you today about how we can serve nonprofits and with as far as community engagement and our social permitting offering here at Saxum.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to dive into this. In fact, I was reading through the website and saw social permitting, and I was like, what on earth is social permitting?
You know, I think it sounds scarier than it really is, but social permitting is just kind of our unique offering here at Saxum. It's a process of engaging the public in order to really gather their support. So when you think about community engagement, I think I always like to say that it's important to design with the community and not for the community. And so how do you ensure that the community, that you really secure their buy-in and when you're engaging in a process? And I think I mentioned to you, like a lot of nonprofits sometimes will be in a room, a conference room, and they really want to develop a plan, whether it's a communications plan or a stakeholder engagement plan. And they want to start the plan from like the beginning till the end without ever talking to a member of the community. And so social permitting is a process that we've designed that helps different entities, whether you're a nonprofit or a company that's building an organization, a philanthropic organization. We talked about the Gathering Place, building a community park or advocating for an issue like criminal justice reform, or if you're even constructing a wind farm, just the process that you would engage to ensure that you have that goodwill, that community support to ensure that your project is successful.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's crazy that you talk about the Gathering Place, because before I figured out where you lived, I was like, oh, they've worked on this project? Like, I've been to the Gathering Place. I think it's a pretty cool place in Tulsa. And they come to find out, like, you and your firm have been working on this thing for, you know, the better part of a decade to get it put together. And it's just so interesting to find someone that was on the ground floor. When I look at things like social permitting, I was like, what do I know from, like, my history that might have qualified as something as social permitting before I heard the term? And I was thinking about how seatbelts got introduced into legislation. And initially, all the senators and congressmen, they're like, we're not interested in this. This doesn't make any sense. And they went to the community, largely targeting mothers and telling them the horrors and all the stats on what was happening for kids that were just standing on the front seat, taking a nap in the back window, all of these things, and then showed them the difference in the stats between those that wore seatbelts voluntarily and how much they survived the crash. And then they pre-drafted letters for them to send to their congressmen and representatives. Before they knew it, they had a flooding of support in the Congress of, I forget which state that served in, but then it was passed as a unanimous 100% thing after they had all ignored like the direct pitch. Once you got the community involved, it was easy to get the thing passed.
You just gave a really great case example of social permitting. So it's like, how do you build a movement, right? I think what was so great about what you just mentioned is it was very authentic and organic to that movement. And we often talk about how your audience doesn't really even need to understand what you do to accept it. It just, they need to trust you. They need to trust the message. They need to understand like what is the ultimate goal that you're trying to achieve. And when there's passion and it feels very authentic to them, when you rile up moms, you better believe they're going to make it happen. But I think that's what's so unique and dynamic about this is just how do you connect with those audiences of stakeholders and really start to make a meaningful change? You know, we have a four-phase approach to our social permitting process. The first is building awareness. You know, you talked about education. You know, you have to educate those stakeholders. And when we talk about the gathering place, you know, we started that project with, it was 10 years. When we started, we didn't think it was going to be a 10-year project. I think the construction timeline was 4 years. But when you're designing with a community and not for a community, the timeline will expand naturally. And so building awareness meant community input sessions. It meant going on a listening tour in the community to ensure that we were engaging with all of the appropriate stakeholders. And then you move into an appeal phase of the process. You know, how do you make a case and really try to ensure that you are appealing to all of the right stakeholders? So, you know, Travis, you're familiar with Tulsa. Tulsa is a racially divided city. Everyone knows that we just, you know, recognized the 100th anniversary of the race massacre in Tulsa. And so it's in the name, it's Gathering Place. We wanted to make sure that we had a park where everyone felt like they were invited and they could come to a park that was designed for them. But that meant we had to appeal to a wide array of Tulsans, and that took time. And then you move into what we call the activation phase of social permitting. And that was a part of the process that I think took a lot of time. It was like, how are we going to get people to come to the park when once this deal opens? And the reality is there were physical barriers, like not everyone lived close to the park. And when we talk about barriers to ensuring that people could come, some of our patrons are low income. So we needed to make sure that there was transportation and easy access. And we had what we called a kid first approach to the park. So we had this really neat creative strategy where we identified a kid ambassador. And her name was Ariana. She was a fourth grader when she first started with us. But by the end of it, she was no longer in fourth grade. She was getting ready to start high school, which was amazing. But it was nice to see her journey as we were kind of navigating the opening of the park. But Ariana was kind of our spokesperson. She would provide regular updates to the families in Tulsa. She was featured in commercials and PSAs. She was very dynamic. She was featured in a music video about the park and bringing kids together and families together. We had what we called a reading tree challenge. So there is the largest tree in the park. We created this animated story that the tree only grows leaves when kids in Tulsa would read a book. So for every book that was read, the tree would grow a leaf. And it was kind of this really neat animated story and got the kids to, we challenged the kids to read 2 million books. And the only way that the park would open was if kids in Tulsa would read books. And that was a wonderful tie to the foundation that was helping fund the park. It was a lead funder. And so it's like, how does the nonprofit also realize its mission, its core mission of early childhood education and making that connection with the park's opening? And so it was this really beautiful community-wide effort. The kids, of course, exceeded our expectations and read 3 million books, and we were able to incorporate it in the grand opening festivities. But that's, of course, a really great opportunity to incorporate it into that activation phase. And then that fourth phase is advocacy. And the reality is there were lots of different components and opportunities for advocacy. What is the call to action? And the reality is we wanted people to come back to the park even after grand opening. And we wanted them to tell their friends that this is a park that is welcoming and that anyone can come and feel like they can bring their neighbors and their friends. And I'll never forget it. The weekend of grand opening, we had 30,000 people at the park. We actually didn't know the park's capacity because it's never been designed before. So it was a one of a kind park experience. I saw this mother who had a toddler and she was signing to her toddler. And it was like this really special moment for me. I remember I had goosebumps because I thought there were a lot of people there. And if you're a parent and you have young kids, can be a little scary. I don't know if I would even bring, you know, young ones to the park for grand opening festivities. We had a live remote. We partnered with the local TV station so that families and Tulsans who couldn't make it out that day could also be a part of grand opening festivities and plan a visit. So we actually had 100 days of opening so that we could create touch points for families in Tulsa if they couldn't make it out to opening weekend. But that moment in time when I saw the mom signing to her young child, I thought we created a safe space. We created a space where she felt like she could come and share in this moment with her family and the rest of what felt like the rest of Tulsa, even though I know we have more than 30,000 people. But it was a really, really great moment. And I think that's what we were hoping to accomplish in that advocacy phase of the project. But those are the four phases of social permitting. The reality is there's so much more to the process. And the way that social permitting works is that it's always evolving and it's a process. And at Axum, we love to partner with different nonprofits so that we can design, you know, kind of a unique social permitting experience.
Yeah, that is really cool. And the launch and the rollout and the creation of the Gathering Place in Tulsa was something cool to witness. I'm in Oklahoma City. Was it like 2-hour drive up to Tulsa?
So yeah, it's not that's about right.
Close. It's not really far either. And we went up. We're not opening day people. We're crowd avoiders. I don't like to wait for things, not because of anything other than like, I hate standing around. I'm perfectly capable of wasting my own time. I don't need anyone's help wasting my time. So we went out, we've been up there a few times. Every time we go, there is tons of people there really enjoying and experiencing nature and being outside in this park. And it's just a great place to be. It's a great place to gather.
I love to hear it. But, you know, it wasn't something that was created overnight. And I think what was so meaningful about the process was there were a lot of community touch points and opportunities to like hear from the community, like, what do you want out of this park experience? And a lot of people are always surprised that it's free, with the exception of like you can purchase food and drink. And even that is really affordable. But people always think that you should be purchasing like an admittance ticket to go in because, you know, there's water features and there are things that you can be doing. And even the play features, you know, were created in Europe and they're one of a kind. They're the play towers. I encourage adults to go on the play towers because they're that dynamic. There's like a zip line. There are things that I think are really unique and engaging. They have free concert series and they do program activation that is really interesting and dynamic and different and things that you probably wouldn't have seen in the area. But I think what's wonderful about that is it was designed with the community. Like the community played a role in helping bring a lot of this activation. And the way that it was designed, and it's a reflection of what the community wanted, hoped to see in a community park experience. And so I think that's really neat.
That is super neat. And there was so much that you said throughout there, like to go and unpack it all. I don't know if we have enough time to go and unpack it all, but you mentioned the 100-year anniversary of the massacre. If those people aren't listening, are not familiar, go look up Black Wall Street in Tulsa. Look what was created. They really worked hard to create their own wealth in the South and it got taken away from them. And then there's this ridiculous massacre For those that are still not, you know, familiar with why people are mad in this country, there's things that have happened in recent history that have, when they try to make it on their own and get taken away from them. You are a first generation American. I know you don't feel that way because your parents were, you know, came over at a certain time, but I understand what it's like to be displaced. I moved 50 times in my life, 36 times before I graduated high school. And I remember getting to the point where I was in Oklahoma in my house longer than I had lived in any other single place. And it's just a whole other feeling if you've never had that before. And it was just crazy. I had to join the Navy to get more stability in my life, which is just a whole other topic. But
Travis, I'm so glad you brought up Black Wall Street. And I would encourage listeners, if you ever want to plan a visit, to not only visit the Gathering Place, but go visit Greenwood Rising, which is a museum that was designed by the same architects who designed the 9/11 Memorial. But it is located in Black Wall Street. And so Greenwood Rising is the name of the museum, and it talks about the race massacre. And what's beautiful about that experience is at the very end of your visit, they talk about how you can contribute and really help support Black Wall Street and the businesses that are working to really rebuild Black Wall Street. And, you know, you talked about economic empowerment and the Black businesses that are really working to rebuild what was once a very strong and viable economic engine in Tulsa. And, you know, we have to acknowledge and recognize that. And I think that's what we're seeing more and more, is that when we think about the social permitting process, there are a lot of projects like, you know, these placemaking initiatives that are taking place. And it's very important to make sure that we're being thoughtful and mindful of these community spaces and honoring them. It is important for us to be engaging in these initiatives. And when you're working on targeted engagement initiatives, not everyone is always going to be happy about your work, right? Even within the Gathering Place, I remember we were working on, we had a large land that was acquired to build a park, and there were a lot of trees on the land, and not all of those trees were healthy. And so we had to naturally take some of those trees down. And there are a lot of people who are very passionate about trees. And so we were concerned that there were going to be protests, and we'd receive notes like, you shouldn't be building a park if you're going to be taking down trees. And so as a communications partner, one of the things that we said is like, this is an opportunity to really identify like who are, there's a spectrum, right? When you think about your targeted engagement audience, there's going to be some who strongly oppose to some who strongly support your initiatives. But the reality is, this could be an audience that you could potentially turn into advocates. So right now they're really angry about what we're going to be doing, but these are park goers. Like, these are the ideal visitors to the park. So how do we make sure that we mitigate this before it becomes an issue? So we had recommended, let's create tree infographic. Like, let's talk about, let's provide them and equip them with the data and the information about what's happening in the park. We created a tree infographic, and we named it a Gathering Place for Trees. And so we wanted them to know, like, here's the information that we do have, because they didn't know. They didn't know that the trees, there was a large majority of the trees that were diseased, and that we were working proactively to treat those trees, and that the ones that were getting cut down were going to be repurposed and actually utilized as part of the construction and the project. And so we started to tell a story around the trees. And then we even gave them more information that they ever wanted to know about all the trees in the park. So we told them about the number of species that are going to be reflected in the park. We talked to them. We used the tree nursery that we were partnering with. We brought all of the spokespeople from our partners to talk about the trees that were going to be featured. And so when we released this, we took out an ad in the newspaper and we shared this infographic. Like, we open sourced the infographic, and the people that we thought were going to protest the park because of the way we were going to handle the trees ended up becoming some of our greatest advocates. And they ended up falling in love with this infographic that we released. But it was just like, how do you take something that could have potentially become a pitfall for the project and turn it into like this major opportunity for dialogue and potential opportunity to turn critics into advocates.
Well, yeah, that's huge. There's a saying is that you can replant trees, but you can't replant the forest. The whole ecosystem that's built in there is not just trees. But I want to jump back a little bit. When you were talking about building it with the community, so for the community, it's so hard to build in the bubble of a boardroom to create anything on your own that's going to be worthwhile and substantial. And your process is going to be longer, but the ultimate end, you're going to get a much, much better project and product when you bring in the community to build it with you. I always get contacted by people who are like, I want to start a nonprofit. I want to do this and I want to do that. And I want to do the other thing. And I ask them, is that what the community needs? Is that what they're asking for? And they're like, what do you mean? Like, you have a desire to do something and help, and that's great, but is that what's needed? And I get so many confused faces, and they're like, aren't you just happy that I want to start a nonprofit? It's like, I'm very happy that you want to contribute to your community, but what exactly does that mean? What does that look like? What programs are in place? What's needed? What's missing? If you haven't done that kind of assessment, you don't know where to put your time, energy, and effort. And so many people get wrapped up in the fact that they feel like I told them they shouldn't do it, that they just go and do it anyways, and that's not the goal. The goal is to make sure we're doing something that's really needed in that area. And it sounds like that's what you did with your whole project of bringing the community into the process and getting that social permitting whole process up and going and running.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing I will add to that is you can't be afraid to go back to the drawing board. So even as you're planning, I think what social permitting and that our process allows for is if you receive feedback throughout the process that something is not working, a strategy that you've deployed is not what the community needs, or the community needs have changed, because we know things are changing every day now and you're receiving feedback constantly because of the way that we communicate. I mean, you might receive feedback that, you know, a community priority has shifted, because the reality is it took a decade to build this park, and the needs of a community in the span of a decade can be completely different. And so you have to be willing to evolve. You have to be flexible and willing to amend and kind of, you know, mold and optimize, you know, your plan accordingly. And I think that is really important. I think that's something that we did. And that's the only reason one of many reasons why we were really successful.
I mean, that's the name of the game, right? You either evolve or you're overcome. You know, Blockbuster didn't evolve. Netflix took over. And right now Netflix is falling off because they're changing the way they do business, but it's not in line with what everyone else is doing. So they're falling off a little bit. You see this time and again in nonprofits, a lot of them that I've worked with, they have older boards, which is fine, but they're so unwilling or slow to adopt new processes, new procedures. And we have this very antiquated way of thinking that it prevents them from changing with the times and becoming flexible and doing what actually needs to be done. So it's great that you've been able to do that with your time at Saxum. Tell us about your favorite project to do other than the gathering place that you get to work on.
So it's hard for me to pick favorites, but I'm going to tell you about the most recent project I worked on. We just helped open the Bob Dylan Center, and that is also in Tulsa. So I feel like I've been spending a lot of time in Tulsa. They are really making a name for themselves as a destination for music and arts. That has been also a long-standing project, because the center in which they opened that project was in an old warehouse. And if you're familiar with the arts district in Tulsa, it used to be empty lots, like parking lots. And the warehouse building used to be called the Matthews Warehouse Building. And I remember going through like a hard hat tour of the space, and to see that space evolve into an arts destination has been really, really remarkable. But we just had the ribbon cutting ceremony last week, and we welcomed what they call Dylanologists. So those are enthusiasts, Bob Dylan enthusiasts from all across the world. I was hosting reporters and members of the media from Spain and France to global media outlets. And it's just really neat to see that center come to life. But I will tell you, I think what is interesting about that process and what may be different from what we did with gathering places, we are trying to change perceptions. And some people think, like when you talk about Bob Dylan, their relationship with Bob Dylan is very different. Like some people think he's no longer living, and we have to remind them, like, not only is he living, he's still on tour. Like he's still like actively, you know, building an archive that's being featured. And so what I think is really interesting about the design of the center is it features an archive, right? Which you usually live in what would be called a museum. And there have been a lot of intentional things done with the center to accommodate this like living icon. And so it's not called a museum, because a museum is something that I think hints at the history, you know, something that is really celebrating the past. And a center is something that honors what's living. And I think that's what's so amazing, is that they're still collecting and gathering items for his living archive. And that's been really neat to work on a project that I think still has a lot of life left in it, in terms of the way that we're kind of engaging in this ongoing kind of social permitting experience. And I think the biggest challenge for that center moving forward is like, how do you attract diverse audiences? Because Dylanologists are like the biggest Dylan fans who have followed his career from like the very beginning. And how do you make someone who looks like me, frankly, how can I start to engage in like my Bob Dylan journey? And I think what has been really interesting is I started working on this project 6 years ago. So it's been a 6-year journey. But I think what's really fascinating is I knew of Bob Dylan, but I didn't know Bob Dylan. And I started to get to know Bob Dylan through my work. And what has been really amazing is there are really great avenues to get to know him. He has a really fascinating relationship with like the social justice movement, for instance. His lyrics, he's like is a very interesting lyricist. He's very spiritual in nature. He won a Nobel Prize, but didn't, you know, show up to claim it in person because of his personality. So I think there's like a lot to like unlock and like unveil about this dynamic personality. And so when I think about stakeholder collaboration, I think about how do we, you know, engage new audiences early and often as the center has opened? How do we incorporate their input as we're working with the center to identify ways to engage those audiences through media? And then how do we change perceptions of who Bob Dylan is in a way that really resonates with different audiences, with the hardcore Dylanologists, and then hopefully the future Dylan, so that the center thrives in 2023 and beyond.
You know, it's crazy you're talking about Bob Dylan, because I know he's a Minnesota boy like I am, born in the Great White North.
Oh, that's
up
right.
There.
You mentioned you're from Minnesota.
Yeah. It's interesting that Tulsa was chosen as the spot instead of somewhere in Minnesota, but I'm sure he's got some things up in Duluth.
Well, I'll tell you why, because Bob, well, and I don't know the answer exactly, but I can guess to why. I think that people don't realize that Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie have very close ties. He, you know, he's a big fan of Woody Guthrie, and the Woody Guthrie archive is just right next door to the Bob Dylan Center. And so, George Kaiser Family Foundation that acquired the Woody Guthrie archive is who also acquired the Bob Dylan archive. And I think that was probably really appealing to Bob Dylan for his archive to be at home right next to his, you know, idol, Woody Guthrie. I think that is there's something there. He also has a lot of respect for the Native American culture. And Gilchrist Museum was a part of the acquisition of his archive. And they have done a lot to respect and honor the Native American.
Yeah, that's a great place too.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think there's a lot of culture in the preservation of Native American culture, and then Woody Guthrie. And I think he thought, why not? You know, like it's deemed the center of the universe. It's the middle of America. And Bob Dylan is someone who performs all across the United States. And so I think he was trying to honor like how he always performed, you know, and cities like Tulsa, frankly, and still does to this day. So,
you know, I thought I was going to interview you. It just really turned into a Tulsa highlight show.
It did. I should contact some of my clients and tell them that they owe me for the promotion. It's a great city. And I'll tell you, if anyone has an opportunity to visit, but I will say, from a nonprofit perspective, it is considered one of the most charitable cities in the United States. And the nonprofit community is really the engine behind Tulsa's success and growth. And so when we think about it from a nonprofit lens and perspective, nonprofits are the reasons a city like that is thriving. And I think that nonprofits, when we think about, you mentioned like how to, and I know that in your podcast, when I listen to it, you guys focus on that. And so the reality is Tulsa is a great case study on how to help build a city, like how nonprofits can really be invested and active in the growth and development of a city. And that's really what social permitting is. It's all about engagement, right? So how a nonprofit can really work with stakeholders to engage in the process and make meaningful contributions.
That's so cool. We've talked about Oklahoma pretty much exclusively, and I want to continue talking about Oklahoma. Tell our listeners some things about, on a more personal level, like how Oklahoma is so different than Oklahoma is perceived by like the rest of the U.S.
Yeah. So, you know, we talked about Tulsa being the center of the universe. I think that Oklahoma is kind of at the center of the United States. And I personally was born and raised here, but I think I mentioned to you that my parents are from different parts of the world and they just happened to meet in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I think that as much as a lot of people try to escape from the state, home is in the name. So we find ourselves coming back. But the reality is it's a very hospitable state. And a lot of people find themselves coming back because I actually serve on the Oklahoma City National Memorial Museum as a trustee. And we talk a lot about the Oklahoma Standard at the National Memorial. And I think that's something that has been embraced by the entire state. And what the Oklahoma Standard means is just really holding your fellow Oklahomans to a level that like they're like family. So Travis, now that I know that you're a fellow Oklahoman, it's like Travis is like family. So if Travis is in need, then he knows that he can call on me. And I think that there's something really special about that, knowing that like your fellow Oklahomans are kind of just like they have your back. And I'm not sure I've ever lived in a state where that's like common knowledge. But we also have, I would say, common values and morals and ethics. That's what the Oklahoma Standard is all about. That if there is a community in need, if there is an Oklahoman in need, if there is anything that ever happens, we kind of rally together and we're there to support each other to get through it. And so also kind of ties back to social permitting, right? It's like, how do you overcome any challenge or hurdle for the common good? The betterment of a community. And I think that's what makes Oklahoma so special. And, you know, the great thing is we're kind of in the center of the United States. So you can really get to any of the coasts pretty easy. It's just you have to be willing to take, I think, a connection here or there. But you don't have to do like the overnight from New York City to LA. It's like you can actually make it to the coast.
Yeah.
And if you start your journey in the morning, you're there by noon. And that's always really nice.
It's so interesting. When I talk to people from the coasts, they just rave about the ocean. And then they consider all the whole middle of the country, just flyover country. And then they're like, well, you know, like the politics. I was like, yeah, people disagree on politics. People will always disagree on politics. But like, have you ever talked to the people? And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, have you ever engaged with the population of whatever place you're talking about? And I know from experience from traveling around the country, I've been to all 50 states, I've been around the world, been 12 nations, spent a year in the Middle East. People are just people. They care about doing well for their household, being reasonably safe and secure, having a pretty good income. If they've got kids, they want their kids to have it better than they did. That's pretty much standard around the globe. And then when you add politics or some other nonsense into it, all of a sudden it becomes a battleground. Like, you want to connect with people no matter where they're from, just turn the news off and be a human being and it's probably going to be just fine.
I love that sentiment, because the reality is we need more dialogue. And one of the programs that I support on the board that I serve on is Better Conversations. And it's all about just like, how do we elevate the conversations we're having, if we're even having conversation, right? And so it's just, how can we connect as human beings so that we can build more meaningful connections?
Yeah. Let's take all the labels out of this stuff. I know we feel better if we can just put someone into a box or put a label on them, and then we know how to treat them or behave or react or whatever. Stop it. Stop putting everything into a little box. It doesn't help you. It really starts holding you back after a while. Just get to know people. People are generally people. They just want to do good things for each other and be safe and secure and grow in this place. So Hoda, where can we go to find out more about Saxum? And I understand you get a free download that helps walk people through what social permitting is. Yeah,
absolutely. If people will visit our website, you go to saxum.com, S-A-X-U-M.com. You will find our social permitting ebook, and you can also contact us for more information. But Travis, it has been such a pleasure getting to know you and having this chat with you. And I hope that this has been beneficial for your audience.
Oh, I absolutely think everyone agrees. Thank you so much for being my guest today, Hoda.
Thank you. Looking forward to meeting you in person.
Can't wait.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.